and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are cracking the code. Well, we're going for source code. We're trying to decompile it and have a look at it. It's a terribly interesting film, and I'm joined to discuss it by Kanan Flowers. How are you, Kanan?
Doing great, thanks.
Now, whereabouts in the world are you at the moment? Are you in San Fran?
I am in San Francisco. I am in the lovely, just outside of the Tenderloin area. If you live in or near San Francisco, then you know that I am surrounded by fire trucks going by and ambulances and all manner of scum and villainy.
I think last time we spoke to you, you're in Texas, so you're back closer to home ground. And also we're joined by Jason Diamond, who's coming to us from New York. How are you, my friend?
Good.
So what have you been up to, Jason? You've been busy?
Yeah, working. We got our Epic M, so we've been furtively working with it.
Excellent, excellent. Well, look, let's get into the show, and we're going to discuss what we think about the show, and then, of course, what we think about the visual effects, but we always do a quick sort of summary of what we think of the show. Now, this film's got some of the interesting aspects to it. I think many of them actually centre around the director, but I'll see what my fellow VFX show hosts think about that. Starting with you, Kanan, what do you think of the movie?
You know, it's interesting. At first, I wasn't sure what I thought about it. I thought I might not have liked it about halfway through the film. And then toward the end, I thought, well, maybe I do like it. And then at the end, I thought, no, maybe I don't. And then I left, and about a week later, I thought, man, I really like that film.
Okay.
And so it kind of reminded me a little bit of his previous effort, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about. It was just so thinky and cerebral, and there was so much going on under the surface that it's not a film you can digest all at once. You know, you have to think about it.
I mean, I certainly, from a film point of view, love any film that I can't second guess what's going to happen next. And I really tried to not know about it going in because I love Duncan Jones' work so much. And I'd so enjoyed the Moon Experience and had managed to do that without being told about it. So I was deliberately trying to not find out about it. And so I was, you know, at various times coming up with completely wrong theories about where he was and what was going on. So I really enjoyed it from that point of view, just from a purely audience point of view. What about you, Jason?
I really liked it. I managed to see it with my brother and another friend here in Queens at the Museum of the Moving Image with Duncan Jones there doing a Q&A afterwards, which was awesome. And what I love about Duncan Jones is, and what's great is that clearly it's part of his filmmaking process because he does it in this movie and he does it in Moon, and he didn't write this movie, although I'm sure he did plenty of rewrites. He manages to bring you in and sort of give you a little hug as a filmmaker and say, it's okay, you can try and make yourself feel smart and figure out what's going to happen, but I'm going to tell you that everything you think you know, I'm going to tell you that you're right, but in the first act. And then I'm going to say, now shut up and let me show you the rest of the movie where you have no idea what's going to happen. And he did that in Moon with the whole clone thing, and he did that in this pretty well with the Jake Gyllenhaal's character. And I really enjoyed it.
Now, anyone want to fess up as to incredibly bad theories they had about what was going on before they discovered what was actually going on in the film? And by the way, I should point out for this, the reason Source Code's been delayed in us doing it is that it's actually only just opened in Australia. It was opened a lot earlier in the US. We have an article on it back in April on FX Guide. But yeah, so that's why we're covering it now, and it's been released very staggered around the world. But so anyone want to – I've got a really huge confessional. I got it completely wrong, but anyone else guess badly what was going on? Well, I actually thought that I couldn't understand why he was cold and why he could, you know, they couldn't sort of talk to him. And so I had some theory that either it had to be in outer space because of the technology that was being used to generate the signal, or way underwater to cool it. Either way, I assumed that he was trapped someplace that he wasn't coming back from. And of course, that, you know, I didn't really have him actually in the room with her at the back of the room until very late in the film when I like kind of woke up and went, oh! I don't know that I was meant to have got it particularly earlier, but for somebody that prides themselves on being able to decode film language, I really got walked down the wrong path.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to figure it out, but at a certain point, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to – they're going to tell me, so I'm just going to back off and just enjoy the film.
Now, Kanan, I don't know if you're like me, but I have this problem with any film that revisits the same sequence over and over again. I almost won't see that film because no matter how good a filmmaker it is, normally I just get bored the second or third time they have to play the sequence again, because they have to establish for the audience that the same thing is happening over and over again. And I just get bored at seeing that. And so that sort of premise has happened in other films, and I just don't like it. What about you?
No, I find it infuriating most of the time. There's a couple of films. I mean, there's the sort of classic film that everyone loves and I despise, which is Groundhog Day. Despite every single person in that film being fantastic and the acting being great, and I love the cast, I can't deal with it. I just can't watch it. And I understand it's hopeful and it's yay puppies.
You just
and
hate
all this
fun.
Stuff, but
you just hate fun.
I do. I do. I despise fun. So anything fun, I'm not going to enjoy. No. So Groundhog Day kind of infuriates me, and this didn't have that same effect on me. Although, like you, for a while, I thought maybe, you know, they call it source code. So I thought for a while maybe it was actually a Matrix-like computer simulation. But it turns out it's far more complicated than that.
Yeah. Now, look, I don't know the answer to this, so maybe one of you guys do, Jason, or maybe you do. Do you know from the talk that the director gave, was this the intended ending? I've heard stories that there were various endings recorded.
He said that the script ended with the sort of little romantic, like, we did it, you know, kind of thing. And then he tacked on the whole, Duncan Jones came up with and tacked on the entire ending with where she sees the body, and you sort of really outline the alternate universes sort of parallel tracks have been created each time they use the source code.
Okay, so everyone knows that this is spoiler central. But so what you're saying is that he went past the kiss in the script, but she didn't get the text message with the alternate universe. Is that kind of the what I'm hearing?
I saw the movie like in late March or early April, I think. So I'm a little fuzzy on exactly where it ended. I mean, he added basically where you think it would in the plot when you saw it and you thought it, like that was the end, and then it felt like a tag. That tag was him.
Okay. Well, I think that it was immensely interesting. And getting back to Cannon's first point, I guess, which was about his indecision whether he actually liked it, I can really kind of see where you're coming from. I actually did love it to death, but I can see where you'd be coming from, because it is a film, which I think is a hallmark of a good film, that you think about. You leave the cinema and you just ponder it. And I found myself pondering this on the drive home and we're having dinner, and I love doing that. I really think that's a good thing. Okay, so let's discuss it, if we can, in terms of the visual effects. I want to set this up a little bit for those of you that maybe aren't as familiar with the background behind the film. We've spoken about the director, and that's great. He's done some really great work, and I guess many of us are fans of his work. But it's been easy to characterize this film as Moon was his low-budget indie film that he did on a, you know, sort of whiff of an oily rag. And this is his big budget. He's got access to as much money as he wants, to anything he wants, with big Hollywood stars, rah, rah, rah. Until you actually realize that the budget for this film was only $32 million. Now, obviously, $32 million is a lot if you're a tribe in the Sudan, but it's not actually a lot for a Hollywood film, not at all, and not a film that relies so heavily on visual effects. So I'd actually say this is an interesting compromise. This isn't that easy to characterize. Now he's got as much money as he wants to burn. This is still $32 million for a film like this. You would still have to be pretty careful with these kind of complicated setups. And to explain how complicated they are, you just have to know one simple fact. All of the shots on the train were green screen in a studio. And once you just take that into account, you realize why the shot count went so high and why $32 million actually doesn't get you very far. Now, you guys know this from listening to this show. You guys know this from talking to me personally. My litmus test of a good VFX show film, when we sit down to do these, is how well you do a comp out a window of a driving shot. And this film had a lot of comps outside windows.
Every shot.
So, yeah, Jason, why don't you lead the right? How do you think these guys scored on that litmus test of just, was it a believable comp out the window, or do we feel like they're on a green screen stage the whole time?
I mean, look, obviously when you see the film, you have to know, even if you don't know anything about visual effects, you have to know that what's happening out the windows is fake. I mean, just it would be impossible to shoot a film on a train that's moving the entire time. So given that, and that's probably a subconscious thing for 90% of people watching the film. I thought it was. I don't think there was any shot that took me out of it. The windows were sufficiently dirty, which in reality were dirty for real on the set. They used dirt on the windows to keep like a real grime feel on the window, as well as they said they could use them for tracking markers as well, because they were they were shaking the train, because the whole train car was set on a gimbal, and they built a train car in pieces so that they could remove it, extend it, take it out, so they could put the camera wherever they needed to get the shots they needed to get. And they went for a sufficiently glowy, diffused interior with a lot of light wrap, so it really felt like you were in this bright, brightly lit train. I thought almost every shot was perfect.
Have either of you guys traveled on American trains? I know train travel isn't necessarily common for everybody. Have you guys?
I take a railroad train every day to New York City from where I live in Queens.
But I mean, this was sort of like more of an intercity train, wasn't it? Than more of
right.
A
yeah.
Because to me, the thing that took me out of the film was that who would design a train where it was so easy to fall from the top deck to the bottom deck and kill yourself?
Yeah.
So the only thing that took me out, I mean, we have trains in. I travel on here, commuter trains that are double deckers. There's no gaping hole in the middle of the top to fall down to the bottom if you got bumped or tripped. So that was the only thing that felt really fake to me, the actual design of the set.
Which they designed. I mean, it was their own train design.
Yeah. There aren't any trains like that in America, right?
No. There are. If you look at the Caltrain that goes from San Francisco down south, there's a big open area in the middle. And then a lot of the Amtrak, actually when I took my trip two years ago, I took an Amtrak, and there was a big opening like that. And apparently, the train that they built was based on the Chicago commuter train. I forget what it's called. It's the Metro 8586 train, which has that issue as well, according to the notes that I read. Although I've never actually been on that train, so I can't verify that.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that was the only thing that struck me as fake. Certainly the window comps I thought were brilliant. Actually, Mark Christensen, who does stuff for this over at FX PhD, completely coincidentally asked, I was having a discussion with him basically online, and he said to me, what do you reckon are the key points for making an outside-the-window shot sell? And I just happened to have noted these down for him during the week for FX PhD. So let me just say what I think they are in general principle, see if you guys agree. I said levels and contrast. Obviously, the image outside is normally too saturated and too contrasty. When we have a car driving and out the window, you see stuff. Focus, obviously a huge issue. Sometimes people just blur the image. That isn't what happens. It's an optical defocus or a rack defocus, and you need to get your blur right. You need to get movement that is kind of multiplaning, in the sense that if you have a bump close to camera, then there's different ways that can happen. But oftentimes, if you just got a comp outside the window, the outside window camera shake, as it were, moves everything at the same amount, where obviously something close to the car, like a telegraph pole, or in this case a train, it would be a siding kind of piece, would move more than a mountain in the distance. There's no actual sort of 3D depth. It's only just a flat plane outside the window. And then obviously, in the case of a car, a lot of it's down to where they're looking, how their hands are moving, and how their bodies are reacting to the way the road is going. The classic problem of somebody in a steering wheel and the background doesn't really seem to respond to that. And then finally, I said it's really great if you can free up the camera once you've done the comp. So when you comp things together, you can move the camera and the comp as one rather than the other way around. Now, I would then say, if you want to see a good example of how this works really well, why don't you go and look at Source Code? Do you think I missed anything off that list, Jason?
No. That is all pretty much the list you would want on your iPhone when you ticked it off, on set. In this case, they shot their plates afterwards, and they had...
Which is really unusual. You'd normally shoot your plates and light your interior where you have control over to match what you don't have control over, which is, of course, your exterior. Do you know why they did that?
Well, I know for the time when they were going to shoot, had they have done it, it would have been like 6 below or something in Chicago, which obviously makes it pretty uncomfortable. But they shot with two setups of three cameras each two exterior cameras crossing over each other and one in the center. So they basically had a 120-degree field of view and an 8K wide DPX, which is what you'd want, pretty much, to be able to move the plate appropriately and make it line up in horizon line level speed and whatnot with each cut, because, you know, no matter if you were on a real train, each cut would not have the exact same speed in the background. So so they had to adjust. They had the wherewithal to adjust based on these giant comps that they made of real plates.
I think that well, I guess you should run it down. The visual effects for this wasn't like a single house that did everything, right? So
yeah, there was like four houses.
Does anyone know who's doing what? I know MPC, and I have a note here about some of the great work that Rodeo did. Does anyone know the full rundown?
I guess Modus, is that how you pronounce it? M-O-D-U-S, Modus FX. MPC, Rodeo or Rodeo, Oblique, and Fly Studio. And then someone was saying that Mr. X did some work on the film.
Yeah, yeah, I got that in our show notes from our research. And certainly we didn't talk to Mr. X, I don't think, for FX Guide, if I recall correctly. But that's not so that it...
Wayne Brenton's listed on IMDb, and he's the VFX supervisor over at Mr. X, right? So
he
was doing it freelance or...
Or somebody moved shop, yeah. Well, apologies to Mr. X if they did work on it. Because I was going to say that the work that... there's some stuff that I think... Once we get past the out-the-window stuff... The next sort of related thing that is terribly interesting to me is the absence of a train when they're at the train station. Because obviously in the story, there's a point the train stops before it blows up. He jumps out and it's a key plot point that he'll throw the bad guy will throw his wallet back in the train. Now, the thing about that, which is really interesting, and I don't know if this is public, but I've seen the before and after plates on a lot of this material. And they just have the doors and then there's just green screen. And there's a shot where we're on the platform looking back at the train, and he gets back in the train. The two silver doors close. Now, of course, the train meets a pull-off, which doesn't happen in reality because it's just a door. There's nothing behind it. There's just green either side. And the camera is pulling back, i.e. away from the train, at like 90 degrees to where the train would be. And I remember looking at that at the VFX shot, and the first thing that struck me is they're not going to have parallax in the comp, and I didn't notice that in the cinema. And, of course, when I looked at the comp, which was the after shot, sure enough, someone had gone in meticulously and rotoed every element you could see through the windows and then multiplaned them. So does that make sense? So as the carriage moved off to the right... The door, of course, which is closest to the audience, would tend to slide to the right. Obviously, the far door, you could see through the train, wouldn't move as much, and so you'd get this parallax offset. And I thought, well, somebody loved this. Like this wasn't a particularly big thing in shot. This is quite a small thing in shot. And obviously, somebody has gone to a lot of trouble. And that's when I started to really sort of pay attention to some of the stuff that was going on with the work that these guys were doing, because it really showed, I think, a meticulous attention to detail. I think Rodeo did 300 shots, and I think I'm right in saying they were on the window shots and on the train shots. I don't know if you guys checked that, but that's what I seem to have.
Yeah.
And it's just great work. I mean, it's just nice, effective, great, seamless work. But of course, the work we should talk about is the big stuff that most people would notice, which is blowing up trains and blowing up huge sections of the cast in fireballs. So enough of my obsession with fine detail. Let's move to the big stuff and go through that. And so let me get your opinions, first of all, about those explosions. And of course, the first one, I think in the film chronologically, is the first big explosion that MPC handled, where the train literally explodes beside another train, causing a massive fireball with the tanker and sections of the train heading off on an overpass. Cannon, what do you think of that as an effects sequence?
Wow. But it looked fantastic. There were so many different components being put together to make it look good, too. There were times when the camera moved, you had multiple angles, you had all sorts of things going on that would cause everything to be problematic. And I believe, like Jason, I saw this a while ago, but I believe there's actually an interior shot out the window during part of it as well, while the train is moving. That's unbelievable. I'm a little confused about some of the shots. Is that the shot where the Phantom...
Is it later where they use the Phantom? I believe so. I don't know for a fact, but they certainly use the Phantom later. There's a sequence a couple of rounds of 8 minutes later where he sits with her on the floor, and if you remember, the fireball comes up towards
the camera. That's where she says everything's going to be okay. That's when they use the Phantom.
And they're engulfed in a fireball in slow motion. And we should discuss that, but let's keep going with just that first one. This is the more sort of classic train exploding sequence, because we get the audience needs to get the physicality of what's going on. There's an explosion on the train. There's another train that's parallel to it on another set of tracks that also we believe is significantly timed to go off at the same time. And it's a big exposition thing in the sense that later on you can just have one sort of flash and we all get that the train exploded, but this was the one that we had to see the extent of it and really understand there's no coming back. Jason, what do you think of that one?
I thought it was great. I really liked the way that you really felt, like you said, the physicality of it. You could feel the physics, even though obviously, again, as a moviegoer, you know it's fake. I mean, they didn't really blow up Jake Gyllenhaal. They didn't really blow up the train. So even the most sophisticated moviegoer, or least sophisticated visual effects wise, still knows that it's fake, and it was brutal. Like, I mean, you see Jake Gyllenhaal's face like burn away, and you see things flying at you, and I believe they cut to a wide shot where you just see, you know, the big wide empty tracks along the side, and you see two trains just, you know, smashing into each other and exploding, and I mean, it sold it perfectly. I mean, all the shots, like you said, they're so meticulously thought out artistically and technologically that clearly the people who worked on the film loved these shots.
Yeah, so now to get our facts straight on the techniques involved, Modus that we discussed before was the company responsible for the train models, but it's MPC that did this explosion sequence we're talking about, the one with the mangled concrete and the big wide shots. Now, that's an interesting thing because, as we know from previous discussions, when we want to blow something up and generally mangle it, it's sometimes a completely different model you need to use because you need to effectively pre-break an exploding section of stuff. And the model may not be built correctly for an explosion, so there's going to be possibly, you know, the need to build completely different stuff. But it was the case that MPC took the clean train and then basically did the hard surface sims to basically blow it up and crash it off the rails, because there's at a bridge crossing, there are cars, and it kind of collapses down the side and stuff. So I think that was pretty flawless. I think that they used Flowline, and there was just lots of good debris stuff. And MPC, one of the major facilities in the world, that can pull this kind of stuff off and do it really, really convincingly.
Well, that's what.
So then we get to that. Sorry, go on.
I was going
to
say that's what's so amazing about it is that you're not just blowing it up. You're blowing it up. You're taking it off the rails. You're mangling the rails. You're handling every real destructive element of what would happen, and they're showing it to you. They're not cutting corners and being like, oh, there was an explosion. Well, mentally, you'd be able to figure out that would buckle and this would... No, you're seeing it happen. Even if it's in a quick shot, they clearly took the time, like they were saying, the top part of the train is the lighter part of the train, so that's going to squeeze and shear and melt and twist, and the big, heavy chassis bottom is going to move differently, and taking all those things into account really sell the shot from a technical point of view.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't think it's non-technical, but the more kind of artistic explosion is the one that Kanan referred to earlier, I think, which is the 1,000 frame.
Right.
They've dropped to their feet. I think they're actually sitting on their asses on the corridor of the train, and we get this super slow-mo composite, which I believe was Rodeo FX doing that, though it might have been Oblique. And it's the engulfing flame stuff, which I thought we've seen some stuff like this, I guess, before. There is a film, I remember, it was called The Day After, I think. It was a God, it was like years ago, a nuclear accident. Certainly, we saw it in some of the Terminator films, you know, slow motions of people basically getting engulfed. It's not particularly easy, of course, because you can see everything.
The day after
that's
was
going
in the
on.
80s. That was like a Jason Robards movie, no?
Yeah. Remember? And there was like milk bottles that melted down and stuff. And in Terminator, of course, it was the famous one at the swing where people became ash and then the explosion actually shattered the ashen bodies.
Yeah.
In this one, of course, we just get an engulfing flame. We don't bother to hang around for the nasty consequences.
But that's what,
I mean, it was pretty visceral.
Yeah, but that's what's great is they sell you right off the top with the sort of the two things you would want to know from an event like this if it were as real. What would it have been like inside the train and what a news helicopter would have seen? And those are really seems like the two angles that they chose. And then after that, you get like the train blowing up off the trestle. So that's like sort of your walking, you know, commuter to walking to the train station view. Then you get the more artistic expression views, like the one Kanan said, or like the one where he gets sort of blown down the middle of the aisle of the train. And it goes back, I think, to the artistic expression that they really thought about all the different ways that you would want to see these things. No one wants to see this in reality, but everyone has the, you know, rubberneck phenomenon where you really are interested to see what would happen if you were able to witness something like this for real, because it's not really that often you get to see things like that happen.
Yeah.
Right. And apparently there's a couple of things going on too, where they did a tremendous amount of simulation to see how the train would buckle and fold and how it would explode. And there's this, there's actually a discussion with Morin about how the way that the train behaves is completely counter to what you think, because all the weight is at the base and the top of it's just basically a piece of tinfoil. And so it folds in on itself at the top when anything happens to the base, because there's no, you know, obviously there's
no
weight.
Right, no structure. Yeah, all the...
Yeah. And so apparently they built all these models, both real and simulated, to see how it would break and how it would fold. And then my understanding is they went out and for literally 2 weeks set small fires and took all of this footage of fire, and then used some of that and then some of the fire in... there's a program called Flowline that they used to create some of this. But anyway, all of this turned out to be really interesting, because a ton of the work, I know you guys didn't do Sucker Punch and whatever, but a ton of the work ended up being the a custom solution. I forget what they call it, the debris toolkit or debris maker or something like that, that they used for wooden structures and fire and Sucker Punch. Because if you saw Sucker Punch, there was just stuff blowing up and fire everywhere. So apparently these guys have created, they've built their own system which generates fire and debris and all of these different things over the course of Sucker Punch and this movie as well.
Yeah, and it was really good. I mean, it's very hard to comp flames. For a whole lot of reasons, and so you need really good sims with really good tools to do it. And you're absolutely right. I think MPC did a great job. But Ken, let me take you back to something else we were discussing earlier. This problem of going over the same event again and again, and how that has the Groundhog Day phenomenon. And you can, as I do, certainly get annoyed by that pretty quickly. I think one of the things that helped this film a lot is that firstly, they didn't just keep playing it over and over again. They had this kind of quick montage implied. He'd done it a lot of times, and let's move on. But also, they explored outside the train. And I think that helped for two reasons. It helped because one time he goes outside the train and it's completely a red herring with the guy he kind of assaults, who has nothing to do with it. And then, of course, later he goes outside the train because he actually meets with the bomber. In both of those cases, it felt like an original part of the film, because we hadn't been there before. This wasn't something that was repeating. I didn't need to see again another sequence in the train. It was nice to get out of the train, because the other problem with these things, they're going over the same footage, it's 8 minutes, you're not going to get anywhere different. So you actually have a lack of feeling like there's air and space. And so you get a kind of claustrophobic set piece, theatrical kind of nature to the film. And I thought, kind of, when they went out to the train station, which obviously wasn't a train station, it was just in front of a car park somewhere, it all felt really good.
Oh yeah, I thought it looked great. And you know, to be clear, we went through, you know, this 8 minutes. We went through that 11 times. Now, it's sort of ironic that none of the times we went through it actually lasted 8 minutes.
8 minutes.
Some were longer and some were less long and, you know, all this stuff. But 11 times revisiting the same scene. So to keep that fresh is really impressive.
Is that including like this sort of quick fire montage they did, you know, like a la Groundhog's Day, where they sort of be like, oh yeah, he went through it like however many times and tried these things. Because I remember they did that. They sort of accelerated it a little bit at one point.
Yeah, my understanding is that the 11 includes every time.
The fast ones?
Yeah, but you're right. There was one set. I don't remember how many times. I'm actually relying on third-party data for that number 11. But there was one time where they went through it multiple times. Interesting. You know, I was just thinking about where I've seen something get repeated before. And, you know, there's a real irony here in that I saw there's a show that I used to watch in the 80s called Quantum Leap. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of times where they did similar where they would do something similar, where he would try something a few times or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of irony to that, right? Because doesn't Scott Bakula play the voice of his father in this film?
Oh, really? Is that who that is?
Yeah.
Do we see the father?
No, it's just a phone call.
Yeah, okay.
Just a phone call. A phone call that starts out with, oh boy, which is
his
the sort of trademark phrase in Quantum Leap.
Oh, was it?
Yeah,
your knowledge of 80s TV shows beats me on that one. I'm afraid. Hey, getting to the visual effects for a second. I guess for me the other thing we haven't discussed yet that I really want to get on to is what we thought of his cocooned pod environment, because it did actually morph around a bit and change around a bit and had some interesting optical characteristics. It was claustrophobic and, of course, also changed depending on where he was in the plot. And for me, was one of the most intriguing aspects of the thing, trying to work out what's going on before he got sent back each time. Did we feel that was handled well? I mean, there was obviously some effects where he was going in and out of the pod, the sort of rapid brain rush. What do we think of that?
I really liked it. There were three, I think they built three sets for that, three slightly different sets, a varying tightness, I guess, size. It was a nice, like you said, because, you know, it resembles a helicopter because he was a helicopter pilot in his, you know, before he got. I guess killed with, you know, that one thing. That was the one thing they tipped as he started saying, I was on my mission, where's my men? That sort of tipped me into a Jacob's Ladder mode, where I assume that there may be some, the whole movie may be taking place in a incident in Owl Creek last moment scenario. And
see, I thought it was good because it was the disorientated person rambling that didn't make sense. But you were from the point of view of the disoriented person that didn't make any sense, right? So for me, what I liked about that, sorry to get off visual effects for a second, is that it just felt like we were seeing a person, and that I've seen this occasionally done well like this, where they're rambling and we're with them, right? We go, yes, that would seem like I was a complete idiot, but it would be really hard if you were completely disorientated. You could easily imagine that scene filmed the other way around, where he's really disoriented, doesn't know where he is, he's, you know, he's got a short-term memory problem, blah, blah, and somebody would just be, what, where am I, who am I, what's going on? But from his point of view, I was with him. So it didn't actually, you're right, it was a tip to what was going on. But I bought it, forgot about it, and moved on, and certainly didn't. I'm not as clever as you. It didn't get me away what was going on.
No, I mean, it didn't give it away. And the way that they explain it in the end makes total sense. And it, again, a good movie can tell you right in the beginning what's going to happen, and you can still... It can still blow you away. It doesn't matter. But
though we're not actually pretending for a second that this doesn't have like major drive truck through it logic flaws, right?
Well, yeah, but it's a movie, so we'll choose not to be overly anal about that, I guess. But I thought the space was explored well. I liked that it got you know, colder, and that he like took it apart and repatched like half the cables, and was able, you know, it sort of showed his ingenuity and intelligence that obviously if he could do all that, whether it's real or not, obviously he's the guy to be able to go on this detective, you know, journey to be able to figure these things out. They're not going to hire just like, you know, like the chef, you know, who was in the army, you know, to do this. You know what I mean? Not that chefs can be smart, you know.
No, but you would. You'd have a combat-trained, you know, special forces op type of volunteer. Kanan, did you? Because you were with me on Social Network, I remember this, where we just ripped them a new one over the breath, cold breath stuff comped in that film. Did you feel that we were okay on this one when he gets cold and they comped in from some 5D footage, some breath puffs of sort of condensed air?
Well, yeah, I thought it was, well, it's certainly better than it was on Social Network. It didn't take me out of it because there were so many things happening around him and so much sort of confusion and such a state of decay that the breath was just one component in the scene.
Well, and he's not backlit with a giant air hose of breath shooting out of his mouth.
Right. And he doesn't have the magic, you know, to stoke the fire amount of breath coming out.
Yeah. Oh, no, you got to stop because I love Social Network and I hated that scene. So it just I can't go there. But Leigh, with this one, we thought we're okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things, you know, I thought a lot about the pod and the sort of point in the story of the pod, and this actually relates to the visual effects. It turns out that the pod was a manifestation of the state of decay of reality based on the amount of damage done when he goes through this quantum entanglement. So as he traverses through kind of a parallel timeline, the more damage he does and the more off track he gets to his mission, the more the pod becomes destroyed as a result of it. And so there's a direct correlation between his actions and the state of decay of the pod. And so you can see that manifest itself through his actions, which I thought was really fascinating.
No, I did. I thought initially it was going to be that he was just decaying. Like every time he did it, he, you know, decayed, he either was somehow physically or whatever affected and was therefore not going to be able to hold up. A bit like a photocopy, right? Every time he did it, he got worse. And yet, that wasn't it. You're right. It was more on the sort of whether it was coming together or not was reflected on whether or not his plot was coming together. But don't you think that the Duncan Jones moment, the reason that you would like, if I'd been with you, Jason, run up on the stage and given him like a man hug, is when you realize that she's only been talking to him through a text line and he's been talking to her with a video?
Oh, that was that when I saw that, I was like, thank you for using your brain. Although, I mean, I'm sure that was written in the script. I mean, I have no way of knowing that, but it seems like that's something that would be in the script, you know, when he received it from Ben Ripley. But yeah, I mean, that's a brilliant little turn for you, which sort of goes to her performance also, because she's being sort of robotic in her delivery. I mean, she's talking to a dead body and reading his thoughts on the screen with zero, you know, as we all know, intent through text is almost impossible. So do
we know the name of that actress that was playing
Vera Farmiga?
God, she was good.
Yeah, she's great.
Because you know what you're just referring to there? I felt that earlier on in the film, I felt she's a bit, you know, for someone that, like I love Apollo stuff. I love any NASA stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the guys that control the missions that are sitting there talking to the astronauts are always really controlled in how they deliver their lines, because the last thing you want to do to speaking to some guys on a real mission in real space is panic the buggers, right?
Yeah.
And so I remember thinking at one point in the film that the way she was acting to him seemed a bit like she was not that aware that she should be staying in front of the camera and paying attention and acting more kind of professionally. She seemed a little untrained or unprofessional in that I was like, I'm not buying her performance that if you were in this position, you would do this. Of course, you know, joke's on me, because of course she was doing exactly what you would do if all you were doing was looking at a piece of text. You wouldn't be looking at a person. You wouldn't have the same sort of engagement of eye contact and sense of talking to them with the same professionalism. You'd sort of forget yourself as she was doing. I give a credit to the actress for outperforming my interpretation of what she was doing at that point.
Yeah, she almost never has eyes to the camera, to his little like web camera, you know.
And when she does, it's, of course, we presume a projection from his point of view, right? So he's picking up on her voice. Like, it's just it's a very well-handled... Kanan, did you find this to be intriguing, or did you just wash over you?
Oh, no, I thought it was fantastic. And, you know, the combination of her acting and the interaction with Jeffrey Wright.
He's incredible.
By the way, Jeffrey Wright, oh my God, he played Jean-Michel Basquiat in 1996 in like one of the best movies. So fantastic. If you're into Warhol and that sort of scene.
It was one of my favorite movies. That is a superb film.
Unbelievable. So I'm always happy to see him in anything. But yeah, there was an interesting, speaking of the state that our colonel is in, there's an interesting scene where the woman opens or sees him inside of this chamber, right? Where he's taken just a partial body, right? He's still on some kind
of
life support.
He's like waist up with one arm and
yeah.
That was just fantastic to me. Do we know who did the visual effects on that? Because I've been trying to track that down for the last 2 days.
That's real, I believe. I believe that was an animatronic prosthetic.
Oh, right. So it wasn't like a... Because normally it's a slab trick, right? You get an actor lying through the table. So their head and shoulders are normal. And then their body is falling below the deck. And then you go out horizontally where they would have been with the fake body. But you're thinking the whole thing was
The whole thing was prosthetic. Because I saw in an article and then like in one of the video making ofs where Jake Gyllenhaal said... They had this crazy animatronic puppet of me, and Duncan Jones wouldn't show it to me until we were done filming. They didn't relate to that scene specifically, but I mean, reasonable deduction would be that would be the scene. That would be the reason you would have that.
That explains why it looked so freaking real. Yeah. I
was focused on the head. I was focused on that head bit, thinking how they. Do that.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, I was looking in the wrong direction. Hey, can I just say, like, I'll fess up, right, that Jeffrey Wright, like, I so didn't believe you that was him from the same film because I loved that film and I didn't put the two of them together, that I just looked him up on IMDb, and of course it is. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So shame on me for not realizing that. But of course, most people would know him from Qantas of Solace as Felix, who was the first African-American Felix, I think, in the Bond series. But by the way, just while we're on him, because I'm going to make it up to that I didn't realize it was him. He was brilliant as Muddy Waters in Cadillac.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
So good. So, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right to draw attention to him. I think he did a really convincing semi-bad guy. I won't say he's a full-on bad guy because I don't think he was... I think he had more nuanced performance than just evil bastard. But
yeah. I mean, in the Q&A when I saw Duncan Jones, you know, he's like, listen, I have Jake Gyllenhaal, Michelle Monaghan, Jeffrey Wright, and Vera Farmiga. Like, come on. You know what I mean? Like, four really good actors. He's like, in reality, I set a environment that they could do their thing in. He's like, you know, I step in, I say, hey, maybe we can try it this way, maybe we can try it that way, and occasionally my way got in the movie. But, you know, you have good actors and actresses. Why are you going to, like, let them do what they do? Obviously completely not working. But, you know, he said Jeffrey Wright came in with, you know, the cane and all the little doodads.
Oh, really?
He came in with his character. He's like, this is what I want to do, the way he spoke. And, you know, although he does that a lot with a lot of his characters, he does that really short kind of mumbly thing, which works amazingly for him.
Well, now I'm more impressed by Jeffrey Wright.
That takes but that's a confident director who can say, I'm not going to force and foist my opinions onto the actors until it's not working.
Yeah, well, you know, it isn't, is it, about directing by telling them where to go and what to do. It's about, you know, giving them an environment to excel. Now, you hear people say that a lot, but it's impressive to get that from a guy who's, what, he couldn't even be in his 40s yet, Duncan Jones. He's got to be in his 30s, right?
Yeah.
Late 30s?
Yeah, mid to late
30s. That's the kind of talent you expect to have that perspective from someone who's, you know, in their 50s and 60s, who's like, yes, well, I've, you know, got the confidence now.
Let's say also his DP was Don Burgess and his editor is Paul Hirsch, who cut, you know, Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. I mean, amongst many other great movies, but just, you know, the DP from Forrest Gump and the editor from Star Wars, you're not doing too bad, you know. And he said,
More the point, the DP from the new Muppets film.
Well, that's really too significant. But, you know, he said Paul Hirsch came up to him and said, listen, I work for you. I don't work for the studio. You know, he's like, and when your editor tells you that, and an editor of his caliber and his reputation, he's like, you know, you feel like, he's like, we had this tight knit group and everyone was working for the film. Not, you know, no one was like a studio guy or a friend of the producers or whatever, and they were all focused on making the best film they can make, and clearly that comes through.
Yeah, I think it must help though when you've got a DP that's got as much visual effects experience from like Forrest Gump to Castaway to Spider-Man to Terminator, right? I mean, like the guy knows how to shoot for effects well. I don't.
But storytelling effects, not like just, yeah. I know how to shoot a green screen, you know.
Yeah. No, you're right. So I was just going to say, one of the great things about having a director that produces something like Moon that everyone really admires is that you can then pull such an amazing group of people together. But I still, you know, for all that, like, let's not get, as I said, I started this out, I want to focus this on the money or anything, but I mean, these are great companies like MPC and Rodean Motors and stuff, but we're still not talking about a lot of money. Like, you can get a lot done if you throw a lot of money at a problem. And this is an insanely talented group of people, but it's still only 32 mil, which is, I don't know that this film would have been any better if they'd had 64 mil or 128 mil.
Probably would have been worse.
Yeah.
Because then you'd have more time to play with stuff and try things that may have led you down the wrong path. You couldn't be like, stick to your conviction and say, no, we don't have the opportunity to play around. This is what I want. And, you know, follow your gut instinct.
I guess we should also just quickly cover off on a bunch of other effects stuff that was in the film, because there was quite a lot of, you know, extra things, some of which I think was more successful than others. I don't know that I totally bought the gridlock out of Chicago. The I think Motus.
Oh, I was just going to talk about that.
Did you think that worked? Because I thought it was a bit sort of silly to myself. Sort of.
Well, it's only silly if you've been to Chicago, and it never looks like that. I mean, they were trying to create something as a result of, you know, an explosion, right? I mean, it was backing up everything. Trains were stopped. I mean, they were trying to build a kind of surreal environment that would have happened had there been a you know, giant train explode and traffic jam. It was Modus, right, that did that using Massive.
Yeah, I just felt like at some point somebody put a car in every available spot. The trouble is that it's like if you say to somebody in visual effects, this often happens. It's like, I want a random distribution of trees in this field, and what they'll get is a pretty much equal distribution in a field, in that every tree will have space around it. There's no clustering. There's no gaps, and that isn't random, right? Random has clusters. It has, you know, groups that form up, and there are other places that are empty for no good reason than they just are. Right. And I feel
Have you ever seen a shot of the 405 in LA during rush hour?
Yeah, but not every direction and every side road is choked. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, the 405 would be choked. Yeah. I mean, you know, I
see what
in
you're
LA
saying, though. Yeah,
and I've driven that and stuck in the 101 and stuff. But the thing is that to get every single road fully choked is almost impossible, because at some point, you know, obviously every road isn't leading out of town, and some are going to have like a breakdown or an accident that's going to cause the cars in front of it to leave a gap. I mean, there's just a million reasons why it's just not going to be every single piece of space full. It just took me out of the film. I was like, it was like one of those classic, yeah, I'll just stick a car everybody, because that like says really traffic jammy. And I thought, yeah, really? Okay.
Well, so your perspective is more that If it technically was perfect or well done, that logically it didn't make any sense.
Because it's just like, if you cover every spare inch of space with a car, then that's not my experience of what happens in any traffic jam, right?
Right. Like it would have been great to have a car shooting down the shoulder or something. Like,
yeah, and,
one
and
dude
a,
cutting,
a couple of crashes know. That caused yeah. some space around them, and, you know, still other roads that didn't go anywhere not being full. I know, it was just like a throwaway shot, right? But I looked at it and went, so obviously an effect shot. It just didn't feel like
oh, you mean they didn't?
Anything
else. You mean they didn't have PAs wrangling a whole freeway full of cars?
Okay, Mr. Smartass. No,
look, all I'm saying is it took me out of the film.
Me out of the film is all I'm saying.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
Okay, so somebody at Modus right now is throwing something at a speaker saying, Seymour, shut up.
But or I'm saying, I told you, we should have put a car wreck in lane three, you know.
I'm just saying that when we criticize shots, we always say why, and I'm just telling you why.
A non-critical shot, and a shot that I didn't realize was a visual effects shot, which is more to the point, is that when he opens the van and sees the bomb inside the van, on set, there was just like a box, you know, a quote unquote bomb in the middle of the truck. You know, I haven't seen it, so I don't know exactly what it looked like. But in the description, they said they had, you know, on the set, they're like, well, that's probably what it would look like. But when they're putting the film together and they get to that shot in the cut, they're like, that looks really lame. What do we do? And then they pack the fucking van full of stuff in visual effects. And you had no idea that was fake. As soon as they cut to that set, I was like, man, that took a long time on set to set that up.
Yeah, good art direction.
Yeah. It's those kind of shots.
And you know what? I think Fly Studios did the VR glitch on, the girlfriend where she looks like she's – which I think was great. Somebody – I don't know if this is true, but somebody said that the direction was make it, you know, look like what happens when Skype starts failing. And I thought that was great. I just bought it as being a sort of – the only thing about it is that I guess it was much better than just like the static problem, you know, they've got enormous and all the hologram thing, which, you know, so tired. So I thought it was a good.
The polygon sort of design tied into the whole transitional element, source code, transitional mesh, quantum mesh, you know, idea every time they went in and out of the source code. And as they teased, which I thought was really nice, they teased what they call the bean, the big basically HDR ball in Chicago.
Now, how well did you think that they matched that shot at the end that Fly Studio did, where you've got Jake in the real space and the reflection of the character that he's inhabiting the mind of in the reflection? Kanan, did you... Because you've got two actors that have to mirror action here. Because obviously it isn't a reflection of him in the reflection.
Oh man, that kind of stuff for me is I'm the worst person to ask because I always see every little nuance that is wrong. So to me, that was one of the places where it took me out of it. I could feel there was just a little bit of a disconnect between the movement, and it drives me crazy when you know someone's talking. But the angle is such that you can only see the reflected mouth moving, and you just know from the way the head's moving on the head that, you know, you have the camera sort of behind, you just know that person is not actually talking because their head is not moving in the same way. So that and the scene in the mirror when he was in the train and saw himself.
Yeah, the bathroom. Yep.
Oh man, both of those are just massive thumbs down for me. You know, if the gridlock took you out, that took me out.
Jason?
I mean, I thought it was well done, but it just didn't match very well.
Yeah, I mean, those things are always a little weird as well. The one at the end, because they showed it to you in the train station and you see, or in the train car in the bathroom, and you see that obviously it's not him. When they show the bean at the end, you're like, oh, well, is the reflection now going to be him, or is it going to be the other guy? Like, how's it going to flip over? We're now in a new timeline variant, you know, number whatever, where he successfully averted the explosions, and it was obviously the other guy. So I feel like maybe they drew attention, at least for me, drew attention to it, so you could really look, in which case it completely destroys the effect because it's not seamless because you're looking for it. That's not a execution problem as much as maybe just an overall story problem, but not really a problem, but just a, you know, a minutia bit of business. It didn't take me out of it totally, but I was like, all right, I get it. He's the other guy. All right, just, you know. Where's the movie going to go? I know it's ending, so what are you going to show me?
All right. Well, to end on that note, I think we think the film's really good. The visual effects are superb. There are a couple of nitpicky things that our nitpicking crew have nitpicked. But yeah, I think on the whole, we liked the film. And certainly, I would happily go and see anything that Duncan Jones did again. We're going to have to finish up the show because we're running out of time. I guess my only thing to ask you, Jason, is if you had only 1 minute left to plug, what would you plug?
The new epic that I have.
Where can people find you?
Where's the mbsproductions.com, like monkeys buy shoes. And on the Twitters, Jason Diamond, one word, like Neil Diamond, but with my name, Jason.
And Kanan, in this time reassignment that we have, what would you, where will people find you?
Oh, lifezero.org. It's my blog. I've been doing a lot of lessons in a programming language called Lisp lately. So if you're interested in learning Lisp, you should come over to lifezero.org and check it out.
So I imagine that when we first put Kanan on this, that there'd be more programming source stuff that we'd be able to pester him about. But I think there's like so little that I haven't even bothered to go there. But thank you for being on the show. Kanan, thank you, Jason, for being on the show. And thank you guys for listening. We really appreciate it. Coming up on the VFX show in future weeks, we have some really cool stuff. We've been catching up on some of our great films and heading into a great summer of films. Hope you've been enjoying them. Please let us know if you haven't, or if you have, post stuff on fxguide.com. And thanks so much for listening. See you next week. Bye.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011, FX Guide, LLC.